Hi, this is Jeff Rogers. I'm the founder of Howdy Jeff, and this is my startup story.
Every wildfire began with a spark. Every superhero has an origin story. And every single startup has a moment that they point to as their beginning. And every founder has a purpose that drove them in the midst of all obstacles. That is the startup story.
Welcome to another episode of the Startup Story. If you're new to the Startup Story podcast, there is a way you can advertise your business for absolutely free. Yes, you can advertise your brand, URL, or any simple call to action for completely free. All you have to do is leave a 5-star rating and a written review in Apple Podcasts. And if you do that, I will read your review in an upcoming episode for my entire audience to hear. So make sure to plug your brand, URL, or social media account in that review. These episodes live on forever, and so will your ad. Again, I'm giving you a free advertisement for just writing a review on Apple Podcasts as a way of saying thank you for taking the time to write that review. And with that in mind, thank you to Rule, who gave the Startup Story a 5-star rating and wrote, "I was searching for information on someone and found that they had an interview on this podcast. I was so delighted with the interview. The length is perfect for a morning walk or commute. The length also enables a better and deeper conversation. I was so engaged that I subscribed and found the next episode equally fascinating. This is now my new go-to podcast for inspiration, motivation, and education." Well, thank you, Rule, for the great review. I truly do appreciate it. And again, reminder for everyone else, if you leave your brand, URL, or social media account in the written review, that is just some extra visibility you will get when I read your review in the podcast episode. These mini ads live on for years to come, so if you want a chance to highlight your business, startup, URL, social media account, whatever the case may be, then just visit Apple Podcasts today and leave your written review. All right, now let's jump into this week's episode. Our guest this week is Jeff Rogers, founder of Howdy Jeff, a creative agency that focuses on typographical illustrations. I'm just going to put it out there right now. His work is incredible, so make sure to visit howdyjeff.com once you're done listening to this episode. This episode marks the 91st episode of The Startup Story, and just my second interview with a purely creative entrepreneur. In fact, the last interview I had with a creative or artisan was episode 8 when I interviewed Brandon Monk Munoz of Monkwood Studios. His woodworking is inspiring. Now, I tee all that up because I believe those who are wired with creative genius are just wired differently than most of us. And for that reason, I find that most creatives truly do not see themselves as entrepreneurs. And we actually talk about that crisis in identity within this episode. Entrepreneurship is so incredibly diverse, and The Startup Story wants to tell all of those stories, or as many as possible. I want to bring authenticity and transparency to the entrepreneurial journey so that you would have a complete picture of how nonlinear this journey truly is. I want to share stories that will resonate with you regardless of the industry our founder operates in. That is why we've extended our storytelling to video with a new initiative titled The Startup Story Presents. Thanks to my partnership with the Think Branded Media team, we will be releasing featurettes on select episodes via entrepreneur.com so that you can see a different layer to my guest startup story. We will also be including a video on the episode page where we create these featurettes. And in fact, Jeff's episode today, right now, is one of those episodes. You can see his featurette at thestartupstory.co/thedesigner. I know you're going to love this episode and all the value that Jeff Rogers is going to bring to us as we explore how he journeyed from playing drums in Texas honky-tonks to some of the most remarkable typographical illustrations for global brands. But just like every story, we need to start at the very beginning.
My dad was an entrepreneur. He wasn't at first. He was a very gifted artist, but he never was. He was raised super conservative. His parents were just ultra conservative and never really supported him to be an artist. So I learned how to draw from him, but he went to school for business and then he got into real estate and he hated it.
Yeah.
And so he tried to figure out something else to do, which was run a bakery.
Okay. All right.
And so he knew, so not that he's like super passionate about baking, but that it was something that he felt like he knew someone, a good friend who owned a bakery. And he said, "Hey, can you teach me how to do this? I need to do something."
Yeah.
He was like, "It'd be great. Yeah." So he trained under him for a few months in 1988 and opened his own bakery and owned it for 26 years.
Wow.
And made a great living, gave us a great life. That has always been part of my story, like seeing how he was successful and he worked his ass off. He got up at 4 a.m. every morning and he did that for us, and he did it. At one point, he opened a second bakery and it was just an abysmal failure. They had to file for bankruptcy, but eventually he was able to sell bakery and kind of do something else. But after his elbows couldn't take it anymore.
Yeah, I bet. Now, so when you think of your childhood, how old were you when you started the bakery? Do you look at dad, the baker? Do you look at him as the real estate guy, the art? Like what do you view your childhood years? Yeah. What was he doing?
I was about 9 years old when he opened the bakery and made that transition. And I saw how difficult it was.
Why did he make that transition?
He wanted to be in control of his life.
Mm. Do you remember a conversation? And I keep poking at that because in all of our stories, I can't think of my almost 100 interviews. I can't think of a single one that came out the gate. I'm building my own empire. Like there's always some shift that takes place in our story.
Yeah.
And being that I also believe that was modeled for you, I want to keep peeling this.
Yeah.
What caused the shift for him?
I think it was just frustration from having a couple of just bad bosses. I don't think he ever felt like he could grow or really make an impact in the business that he was in under working for people who didn't care about him.
Mm.
And so he was fed up.
And how old were you when this shift took place?
About 8 or 9.
8 or 9. Okay. Yeah. So relatively young, probably oblivious to some of the challenges.
Totally oblivious. We were having the best time.
Exactly. Like my dad brings home sweet treats.
Yeah, we're good. We're good.
So as we continue on in your story though, you know, we're coming into high school, right? And in high school, especially the end of high school, it's the end of a natural chapter for us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what did you think you wanted to do?
I didn't want to run a bakery.
Yeah.
Because me and my brothers worked at the bakery a lot. And that was also very helpful to see him firsthand with what he was doing every day.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't even know what their dads do, you know?
Yeah.
Knew exactly what my dad did.
And you get to see how hard that business is. So that's awesome.
And we had on Christmas Day or whatever, or Christmas Eve day, we'd show up at 5 a.m. looking all tired. And he's like, hey, stop looking tired. You know, it's time to work.
Yeah.
Don't look tired. I've been here for 4 hours already. We're like, okay. And she's just like, work.
I love
do
it.
Do your work.
I love it.
It's awesome.
That is awesome. That's a work ethic you don't see a lot these days.
Yeah.
And you don't see parents pressing that hard these days. So
But
that's a whole other podcast. Uh-huh. I could talk about that.
Yeah.
I could talk about that.
Oh, totally.
So again, you saw the work ethic. You worked in the bakery. Coming to the end of high school, you realized you didn't want to be a baker. What did you think you wanted to do?
I always knew I wanted to do a job that was fulfilling. I think, and articulating it or saying it like that now, when I was in high school, it was, I don't want to sit at a desk and I want to do something that's fun for my job.
Yeah.
I want to do something that makes me happy.
But you say fun, like what was fun for a high schooler is so different than fun for maybe you and I now, right?
Yeah.
So like when you think of a job out of high school, because we all have thought of something, you know, what was that thing?
Specifically in high school, I wanted to be a musician. I'd always been interested in art and I knew I was always going to do that.
Yeah.
But when I got into really deep into music, and I happened to have a couple of incredible teachers going into college, and I was going to be a music major and I was going to be a musician because that's what like was super fulfilling and fun. You know, that shifted obviously, but in high school, that's where my head was at.
And so as you're wanting to pursue that, as you're entering into college, what did your dad say about that? Right. Because his story is actually a story of having a passion for something, not pursuing it, and then coming back to something he did enjoy with some challenges, of course.
Right.
But so where was he at with you wanting to do that?
His response to his parents, and they were great, you know, everything, but they didn't really support him. His response to that was he was going to just support me and my brothers no matter what we wanted to do.
That's awesome.
As long as we worked hard.
Yes.
And he wasn't going to let us just try a bunch of stuff and quit. But if we were really into it, he was like, go for it, do it. You know, I was like, I want to be a musician. He was just like, great, do it. Where are you going to go to school? You know, let's go. I was like, I want to go to UNT. It's the best music school. He's like, great.
So you go to college, you go to University of North Texas, a good music program there. While you're there, obviously heavy music courses. Are you still thinking through your 4 years? Take you 4 years to graduate? How long was your
five?
5 years. So through your 5 year journey, did you end your college thinking, I'm still going to be a musician?
No.
So what happened in the 4 years where you started realizing that wasn't the story to play out?
Well, it was pretty quick when I realized that my whole big dream of in music at that point was to be, I was a drummer, wanted to be in the drum line at UNT.
Okay.
And I made the drum line my freshman year and I did it. And I was like, well, I did the thing that I wanted to do, you know? I was like, there's literally nowhere else to go unless. So I started playing more drum set, but then I really looking at it to make a living, I'm going to have to be a band director or I can be a session musician or a touring musician.
Okay.
And I'm like, shoot, I'm going to have to rely on this passion to make money. And I'm going to have to do a lot of stuff that I don't really want to do in music.
Yeah.
I figured out with music, I want to always just do exactly what I want to do with music and play in the bands that I want to play in. And maybe that's not the, so I switched back to art.
Got it.
As a career path or whatever. And I was like, I'll always play music. And I always have. That's a huge part of my story is what music taught me about graphic design and art making. But yeah, I had that shift. I changed my major a few times. It was like communication arts and then 2D studio. It was like, I'll be a painter, you know? And then like, nope, I'll be poor. Like I can paint. Oh, let's learn. We're in college. Let's learn something I don't know how to do. So it's like, I'll learn the computer. And that's when it shifted to graphic design. And that's when I discovered what that was, I think my junior year or something.
So if you were to think back to your college years, again, I'm all about these decision points in life. Like there's just so many of them.
Yeah.
And some are natural decision points. End of high school, end of college, marriage, kid. Like there's natural decision points, but there's some that are subtle. But again, end of college being an organic one, what did you want to do with that degree coming out of college? What would the 23-year-old Jeff say what you're going to do with this degree?
When I graduated from college, I kind of just started learning about graphic design. I mean, I had a graphic design degree, but I'd only spent less than 2 years digging into it. So I was still very green. And my thought was, I'll find a job at a really awesome design agency and like just keep getting better and I'll like rule the world. But what actually happened was I just went on tour with a band for a year after I graduated with my graphic design degree.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
So, and I'm really glad I did that. It was a wild year.
So let's put some timestamps on things. So what year is this right now? What year are you on tour?
That was 2001.
2001, you're on tour.
Yeah.
And let's also not overinflate or understate how significant it was. Like how big was this tour? A year on tour. That's across the U.S.?
It was Texas. So it was, and this was, it was weird because I didn't really like the music. It was a Texas country band. And a lot of people, if you're a fan of country music or Texas country, his name's Aaron Watson. He's pretty huge now.
Okay.
Not so much when I was in the band, but he is a businessman and he was going to make it. I was like, he's going to be huge one day. And that was like, I lived in Dallas with my roommate who played bass in the band. Somebody I played music with for years decided to go. And I was like, I'll only do it if Dylan comes too. Because we were like not into the music. Yeah. And so we'd go to these honky tonks and stuff, just like standing in the corner, just like observing like these people are so crazy. But it was mainly...
It was like playing at the zoo every time. Like, look at these species out here.
It's literally like one time there was an entire family down in Bryan, Texas. There was a whole family with mullets.
That's awesome.
Mom, the dad, everybody had the exact mullet haircut.
That's awesome. I mean, it's almost like the people of Walmart Instagram.
Oh man. But it was a while. There was like a couple places with chicken wire across the front of the stage and that kind of thing. But it was pretty well. So we would be in Dallas for Monday, Tuesday, and then we'd drive. We were based out of Abilene, Texas. So the rest of the band was there. So we'd drive to Abilene and then do like a 4-day tour playing in Amarillo and come back down and or go down to Houston or go to Louisiana or something. Each week was like a little mini tour.
Okay.
So we did that for like a year. So we weren't ever gone for like months at a time on it because we rode around in a Ford Excursion, and he's got like three buses now. So it's like, thanks a lot.
Drastically different, right?
Yeah.
They're drastically different. So at the end of that, though, I mean, obviously, you know, for the musicians that are listening, or those that had, you know, musician dreams before their current business, I mean, that sounds like a dream come true. Like,
yeah.
That sounds like you got paid to do what you wanted to do. Now, granted, you had shifted and you were a designer, but did that come in to an end because the tour came to an end, because you were done, time to go on and do something different? Like, why did you stop doing that? And then what was your first design gig? Because now not only are you only 2 years experience in graphic design, you had a 1 year break.
Right.
So how did you get back into the scene?
So I was kind of getting tired of eating Wendy's dollar menu, you know. I made a living, but it was not much. And in that point in Aaron's career, where we were a solid band, but and he positioned himself to open for these huge acts for like hardly any money. So we played in these in front of these huge audiences, and the exposure was crazy.
Yeah.
But no hotel, we were, you know, schlepping it.
When you say huge audiences and big names, like who were you opening for?
We opened for people like Pat Green, Joe Nichols, Coup de Grace, and like at Houston Rodeo in front of 5,000 people.
Very niche audience, though.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know any of those names, as I'm sure.
I wouldn't have either.
Yeah, okay.
But Texas people, like, they definitely
know.
Do.
Yeah.
Yeah,
they knew. Okay.
So it was big audiences, and that eventually did it for him. As an entrepreneur himself, he's got a pretty amazing story. But I wanted to marry my girlfriend. I was like, I gotta make some money eventually.
Yeah.
So let's stop this and try to go use my degree and get my first design job, which ended up being at SBC, which is now AT&T. My now father-in-law's cousin ran a certain department within the company called the Proposal Center. And I got a job making covers for proposals and I was there for like 3.5 years, and I literally would design a cover, print it out, and put it in like the plastic sleeve of a 3-ring binder. That was my job.
Okay. I want to pause on that for a moment, because as I think of big corporations, it blows my mind away all the roles that are created within that.
I know.
I mean, now looking back, you're probably thinking to yourself, like, that was not even necessary.
Right? No.
Of course, it
was not necessary.
Digital proposal, but forget the technology side of it, just the headcount side of it. It's like, that is the role. Wow.
It was weird. I learned a lot of valuable things there, but I also when I was in the band, I was taking every opportunity to make merch, you know, like do all the t-shirts and do whatever I could design wise to keep practicing. Not that I always felt like I was practicing, it's just because I wanted to.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, ooh, let's make some t-shirts. Let's do the merch. And so I was still doing design.
Was there any part of you that was just disappointed with that SBC / AT&T job coming off of the creative year that you had of playing in a band, being on tour, creating merch? And obviously, I'm assuming the designs were creative in nature.
Yeah.
And really what you wanted to now doing proposal covers. Was there a level of disappointment that you had to wrestle with at all?
I was super pumped.
Really?
I was so excited because it was my first real job doing graphic design. Then that's all that I cared about at that point. I was like,
okay,
I have this job. I'm getting paid a lot of money, you know, like, and I can get better and I can improve and I'm here.
That's awesome.
And then eventually they were like, we need some more people to do this. I'm like, okay. So I hired like three of my friends. So we were just hanging out, making a very low stress job. But I got pretty frustrated pretty quick because I didn't have a mentor.
Yeah.
I was quickly promoted to the head of that department, which was like 12 designers all across the country who were all like in their 40s. And now I'm this kid who's their boss. And they were all disgruntled and ended up being kind of weird.
So but why, let's talk about that being frustrated. Why were you frustrated? Because you didn't have a mentor?
Yeah. I felt like my work was not improving. Like, I felt like I was really, really stuck.
Okay.
Like, I wasn't able to do anything. And at that point, I had this idea that I needed a good job to be a good designer, which I know now is not true at all. So I got into this like death spiral of, if I can't find a good job, I'll never be a good designer. But who is going to hire me if I can't become better? If I can't get better, then I'm not going to get a good job. How do I get out of this thing?
Yeah.
That was like a year and a half. And I was just like totally not motivated anymore. I just felt tired. Didn't care about anything, you know, just because it was so exhausting mentally to be frustrated at work and not knowing how to change anything. Oh, and the other misconception I had was, if I go and show my work to somebody, it's got to be good. It's got to be really good before I show it to somebody. But that's not good. Yeah. And I know it's not good. I don't know how to make it better. So I eventually was like, screw it. I have to talk to people about my work and ask them how to make it better. And so I just started, like, the people around Dallas who I thought were the best creative directors, the best agencies. Yeah. I started calling people. Can I come show you my work so you can tell me why it sucks?
you know? I love that though.
And it felt horrible. It felt like I was totally exposing myself, you know?
Yeah.
It was uncomfortable.
Well, I mean, that is a very humbling and vulnerable position to be in.
Very.
You know, but I will say, I commend that you had the foresight and willingness to do it, because, well, I think the idea that you had to work with a better firm to become a better designer or something to that effect. Yeah. Well, I don't necessarily agree with that. The fact that you saw the need that there has to be something that continues to grow you as a designer to get better. Like, I love that.
Yeah.
Absolutely love it.
After I started talking to people, you know, there's some smart people out there. And almost every single person that I contacted said, like, yeah, come on in. I've been happy to check it out. And what I found was, most of the people were like, this is good. I was like, you could work on this and maybe change this, but it's cool.
Yeah.
And I'm like, is it? I don't know. So I was just desperate. I was desperate to get better. And so even though it was really uncomfortable, what I learned from that was, like, at the end of a meeting, I'd be like, is there anyone that you know that might be a good person to talk to? And like, oh yeah, old Bob at what's his name or whatever over at this agency, it'd be great. And they're like, oh, great. And then I'd email that person and say, hey, Jeremy over here said that you'd be a good person to talk to. Like, oh, I haven't talked to that guy. And then it was like this connection.
Yep.
And I was like, is this what networking is? I was like, this is networking. So advice I give to like younger designers all the time is like, don't call people looking for a job.
Yes.
Call people because you want to get better.
Yeah.
And you want their advice, because that will ultimately show them. But you have to be honest with yourself, too, about that and not be manipulative or something. Yeah. You have to first want to improve and take criticism and work with the criticism, then keep in touch with people, because then they will see that you're serious and you have enthusiasm and you can work with criticism. And I always say, like, can I work on this and show you and see what you think? You're like, yeah.
See, this is what I love. So, again, for those listening, I hope you are seeing the value in just this key takeaway. If there's anything you got out of Jeff's story, this takeaway could carry you for so long. I mean, just the idea, and this is where people get hung up, right? We have this idea that we have to be the experts at what we're doing. Therefore, that means we can't ask for insight and guidance from others.
Yeah.
And one, absolutely false.
Right. Yeah.
Completely bogus.
Totally false.
It is a limiting belief. It really boxes you in.
Yeah.
Where, you know, and look at from that decision point you had where you met with other designers just to get input, how many no's did you get as you reached out to people?
None.
I
would get silence or yeses.
And silence, I mean, you know, look.
It's like you're busy. People are busy.
Exactly.
I get it.
Yeah. Silence is completely different than a flat out no.
Yeah.
Right? But you had a ton of yeses. I inherently believe, now, Grant, there's a bunch of tools out there. Let's just be very clear about that. But I inherently believe people want to help.
Yep.
And if you come to me or you go to anyone with sincerity asking for guidance, help, direction, whatever, I don't have a statistic for it, but I have to believe 8 out of 10 times, it's going to be a yes.
Yeah.
What you also did that I love that I hope everyone picked up on was that secondary referral, right? That connection. And again, I don't know, you know, what year was all this taking place in?
This was probably 2004-ish.
So 2004, right?
Yeah.
So LinkedIn wasn't around yet.
No.
But you know, 2004, again, yes, I love that you discovered networking. I love every bit of it. But it's like all those things people have forgotten.
Yeah.
Because of the ease and simplicity of LinkedIn. It's like, hey, can you make an introduction? And then they go in and do a connection request and it stops there. Mm-hmm. It's like, that's not a relationship. No. That's just a connection online.
No. Yeah.
You know, so I love all those things. And again, as an entrepreneur, all of this stuff is applicable too, because if you're a fitness owner and you were going through COVID, like there are fitness owners that have succeeded massively in this season of life. And if you're struggling, if you were to reach out to them, I can assure you they're going to want to help.
Yeah.
I've had people reach out to me just for guidance, whether it be podcast related or startup related or investment capital related. I will it may be, you know, 4 weeks before we get a call,
right,
but I'm going to try and fit as many as possible. As people want to help inherently.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I have to ask, if people reach out to you, are you willing to help?
Absolutely.
That's the thing. It continues to go.
Yeah. I feel like it's my duty.
Yes.
I mean, for the people that helped me and how huge it was for me, just the conversations.
Yes.
Anytime anyone emails me, wants to talk, I every time we'll talk to them. I'll sit there and write an email back. Well, what's frustrating is 80% of the time, no response back. Nothing.
Yeah.
But that is like every time that happens, I've put people on the spot before. It's like, hey, also, somebody take some time to help you. Say thank you.
Yes.
You know, yes. That's gonna help. I was like, oh, I got busy. I'm like, I guarantee you, I am busier than you.
Yes.
I am much busier than you.
and I think that ties back to the sincerity, right? Like if all you're looking to do is to consume someone's time to get input, like just don't be a tool. Like just don't even do it. Like, but if you truly value the person's insight and advice they're going to give you, then show that value after the fact through gratitude, right? So so you meet all these people, you make these great connections. I assume you start I say the word encourage, but not the way the world thinks of it as like, oh, you know, such kind words, but like literally courage being placed inside of you. Like you started increasing in your own personal belief of how good a designer you were. So as that belief started to increase, when did we get to you doing your own thing?
Right. Well, in meeting some of those people, there are little sound bites, you know, from that have carried me to this point. There was an art director, Paul Jurdy, and he took the time to talk to me. And I was doing my big complaining thing about how do I get a good job if I don't get good work, you know, if I don't have work. And he just looked at me and he's like, just do the work that you want to do and eventually somebody will pay you to do it. And I thought that was ridiculous. Yeah. I was like, you clearly don't know my plight. Like, you don't understand. Yeah. You're already, like, successful and everything. But it wasn't until later, and I was just, like, absorbing everything I could, just trying to figure out. I was fully motivated to, like, move. That phrase really clicked when I understood what he meant was, you got to do the work that you want to do. Which, for me, it meant, oh, I have time at night. I have time on the weekends. Yes, you're going to have to make a living. You're going to have a job.
Yeah.
But you are in control of all that other time. And you have all the control in the world as far as like how you want to use that time, what projects you want to do, what you want to try and get out there and how you do it. It was like this aha, like, I don't need a good job to get better. I fully can own that myself. That's my job.
That's incredible. That's so so powerful as well. It's funny. The moment you said that, when you mentioned the quote, I didn't go there at all with it. I was like, oh, this sounds, I'm curious how this is going to unpack itself. Yeah.
Because it sounded crazy.
But then as you started talking about those extra hours, I immediately went back to, this was probably, 2005. I was an employee. I was an accounting manager of all things.
Mm-hmm.
And a team of accounting assistants. And there was one employee who was spectacular at just data entry. She was so incredible at it, so fast at it, so quiet, so diligent. But she was an amazing artist. Mm. I remember asking a question like, why don't you try and do this full time? Like, you know, try to sell your stuff, whatever. She's like, so because for her, it's like, then it won't be fun.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I come here to do brain dead stuff so that I can do creative stuff.
And
later.
That's what music was for me. That's exactly the thing that
I love it.
That's what music was. Like, I'll do music on my own when it's the most fun.
Yeah.
If it's a job, that won't be fun.
I love it. So you start honing your craft in the after hours, if you will.
Yep. And just asking everyone, my wife, I got married and my wife's an actor. So if she was doing a show, I'd be like, you need a theater poster? You need a poster for the show? Like, I'll do it.
That's awesome.
You don't have to use it, but I get to do whatever I want. No revisions, you know?
That's awesome.
But I'll do it for free. So I started doing that playing with a lot of bands still, doing little records and live recordings. I'd make CD packaging for all that stuff and just, I was really having fun doing that. And as my stuff was getting better, I was still getting out there and talking to people. And then my wife, who is a similar story as me as an artist, we were at dinner and she just like, we were just talking about, we want to do something with our lives. We have to do something crazy. And so she slammed her hands down. She was like, let's move to New York. And I was like, okay. And she had like tears like in her eyes. She was like intense, like, we have to do it. And I was like, let's do it. Next year, let's move to New York. Let's save up. So it was like 2 years.
Yeah.
And during that time, I got better and better jobs. The next job I got was a web design studio, which I learned that I don't want to make websites. Left there. And then got a job at a cool little boutique studio. And all this, I could talk for hours about each one of these little steps. But and about quitting my first job and how like, you know, like
liberating it was.
Yeah. And like how scary, but then he's like, oh, it's fine. And
but all those little steps though. And again, you know, for the sake of time, we won't go through every little step, but looking back though, before we jump into your venture, do you see each of those as an actual step up and forward? Or, I mean, how do you view that those seasons of life leading you to where you are today?
They were definitely, you know, if you're thinking about like a staircase, there's to steps up for sure. I was walking on the ground at AT&T.
Yeah.
And then once I started moving, I was taking little steps up. Each person I talked to, every time I spent something, did another project, sometimes what I was working on sucked.
Yeah.
And didn't work, but I learned something. And then I really got to where I loved learning, you know, and being in a position where I was the dumbest person in the room, basically.
Yeah.
Because then I knew I could learn the most.
Yeah.
And I put the uncomfortable part of that aside, knowing that the payoff would be huge. It's like, awesome. I can do some discomfort. So that's why moving to New York was like, yes, that's terrifying. Terrifying. Let's do it. When we moved to New York, we drove up in our car just full of our stuff and got this teeny tiny little 300 square foot apartment.
New York living.
Yeah, dude. And we were so excited. It was like the thing that you asked about SBC. Like, were you kind of bummed? And I was like, no. It was great.
Yeah.
Looking back, it was like, oh, that was awful. But at the time, you're like, this is awesome. We don't have a job. Like, you know, let's do it. So I don't even have an iPhone at this point. So I was like trying to navigate.
What year are we
This
at?
Was 2008.
Oh, like, yeah. No iPhone.
So I was like trying to figure out the subway and like, but I just went for it. Just like I had practiced doing here, like, I went and, the other cool thing that I didn't say was as we were about to move to New York, all these connections that I had made around town, I got two job offers right before we moved from incredible agencies.
Oh, wow.
Because they needed someone.
Yeah.
I was around. They knew me. I had a face. I always tell people, if you have a face, people will be more likely to want to, you know.
100%.
Yeah.
100%.
Go talk to people, like meet with people in person.
And you've already proven yourself as teachable. That's the thing. Like, I mean, there's again, we could spend a whole podcast on just the value of humility, being teachable, networking. It's so powerful. And people, I think they have shelved the value of what that brings.
Yeah, because now it's all about, I have to put myself out there as the expert, as like the best version of myself, which you're right. Like that, you lose so many opportunities to become better at what you do when you're like, I'm the best.
Yeah.
It's sad.
It really is. It's a one-dimensional life.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so...
Like, you don't have to always be the best.
100%. There's so much to be learned from other people.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It's unbelievable.
It's incredible.
So Spotco. So you end up at Spotco.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, what was that learning there for you?
Oh, my gosh. That's really the point where things took off like crazy because I got to... And again, I showed up about 6 weeks after we moved and got it. And I was like, I was going to Comedy Central, and I was going to New York Times, and I was like meeting all these people.
Yeah.
People were like, I think Comedy Central was like, you should come work here. And I'm like, oh, what? So like I met at Spotco. This was all within like a couple weeks.
Yeah.
This woman, Gail Anderson, who is, it's like, if you're a designer, you know who that is. Like, she's one of the top people in our field.
Yeah.
I met with her at that point, didn't know who she was.
Yeah.
I would have been like very, very nervous if I had known, you know, but I was like, turns out they, and I had a bunch of theater posters in my portfolio, and that the agency worked on Broadway theater advertising for Broadway theater, basically making theater posters. And somebody had just put in their notice the week before, and she was like, she looked at it, she was like, great, great. Can you start Monday?
That's awesome.
And I was like, fell in my chair. So I started, and I felt like the dumbest person ever. The other designers there were incredible.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I cannot, I'm going to get fired. I don't know what I'm doing.
Can you give, just for those listening, can you give a frame of reference of what you saw in those designers based on your skill set at the time?
I perceived it as, and talking to them later, they didn't think I was bad or anything. Mm-hmm. I just perceived their work as being very refined, and just all their ideas, they could just spit out 1,000 ideas and they were great. And then Gail, she's a freaking genius.
Yeah.
I mean, she's a brilliant artist and designer. Working with her, you know, that first year, I'd be trying to work on something, some brochure or something. She'd come over, she'd like sneak up behind you and look at your screen, you know, like, what are you working on? I'm like, I didn't see you. She's like, what are you doing? Why are you doing that? I'm like, I'm just trying to figure it out. Just move over. So she'd like just sit down.
Yeah.
And in a matter of seconds, move this, move that, do this. And it was beautiful. And getting to watch her do that, technically do it, and then to talk about, and she's a teacher. Okay. So she's, that's her heart. Like, she is a teacher. Now she runs the design program at a School of Visual Arts in New York. When we got into her like teacher mode, she's like, see, this kind of type, it has this kind of weight. So you want to pair that with this because you get this emotional response, blah, 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 blah. And so it was like,
that's awesome.
I'm just learning.
Yeah.
Like every day, and also feeling like super nervous every day.
But the amount of growth that took place.
Oh, huge. That first year, I was so uncomfortable. I was just like highly anxious, but really trying hard. And then it took about a year where I was like comfortable. Gail trusted me. We started doing side projects together, designing books and all kinds of crazy stuff. I had that habit, even though the job was really amazing and fulfilling, like as a designer, it's kind of a dream job.
Yeah.
I still would go home and work on stuff that I wanted to work on because I was in that habit. It would have been weird at that point to not.
Early on, your side gig, if you were, was to improve your own skill set. I mean, that's why you created these theater posters when you were in Texas. And now you're in New York and you have some side gigs working with Gail on some book things.
Mm-hmm.
What was the reason for the side gig at that point? Was it still just to improve and learn? Was there some monetization opportunities in that? What was the reason for it?
It was fun. It was super duper fun. I'm the kind of person, like, I'll get just obsessed with something. The deeper you dig into like a subject or a hobby or something, you know, it's like when you get real deep, you just think about it all the time.
Yeah.
And that was the way that it was. And I was learning so much at work finally that I wanted to take what I was learning and try stuff with it and experiment, where I couldn't do that. Like, I had a very specific job there. I was an art director. So I was designing posters, coming up with the concepts and hiring illustrators and going on photo shoots and all this stuff. But as I was learning stuff at work, I wanted to come home and be experimental with it and try stuff and tinker with it, you know, in like my old workshop, you know, in the privacy of my own, like where no one could like see me fail.
Critique it, right?
Yeah.
So if you have this dream job, you're doing things that you absolutely love in the evening hours, why change it all up and start something new?
It was a similar reason as my dad wanted to run his own life and be his own boss. But it was also the more I was doing that. And at the time, social media was kind of, it was Flickr. I don't know if anyone remembers Flickr, but I was putting
was
stuff
like
out.
Photos. I think photos, right?
Yeah.
And that's really what it was.
Okay, mm-hmm. Yeah. But I was putting stuff out there. And so there was all these design blogs. And so things would get picked up, go viral or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
on a small scale, people started to know who I was from my own work. And then I started getting calls from Nike and New York Times and actual clients paying actual money for me to do assignments.
Okay.
Just like I was working on with Gail. So I'd already practiced and had some cool opportunities to do some high profile stuff with her. So I knew how to do it.
Yeah.
I was also working with illustrators every day. So I knew what a bad illustrator was to work with, what a good illustrator was to work with. And I knew that if I got hired by someone to do a job, I'm going to do it really well. I'm going to go above and beyond every time, and I'm trying to get them to call me back.
you know,
like that's my goal. Please the client, make sure that they're super duper happy, but also get some good work out there and, you know, try to get them to call me back. So I was learning all that stuff at the job, at my job, but then started getting some real work on the side from that and sharing work before Instagram, before other stuff.
Yeah.
When I officially jumped ship, Spot Code kind of shifted. Gail had actually left. A couple of the other designers had left. The departments sort of merged in this weird way. And I knew how to do that job really well. And I was kind of left to run a couple of the accounts, and I was bored.
Okay.
I mean, I could have stayed there for 10 years.
Yeah.
But I knew I was in this habit of like, I need to get back into a place where I'm uncomfortable. Where is this going?
Yeah.
I don't know if I want to do this for the rest of my life. I got to get back to a place where I'm uncomfortable. And I know that I can probably do it because I'm already getting this work. And then my wife got this incredible gig on Broadway making like gobs of money. So I was like, okay. So that was helpful.
Yes, it is.
So that was a helpful like kick.
There might be some listeners saying, well, of course that's going to be helpful if you have someone else. But that's part of the entrepreneurial journey, right?
Yeah.
I mean, part of the entrepreneurial journey is that if you're married, this isn't your own journey. Like, it's a team effort.
Team effort.
So that's part of it, yeah.
Yeah. But the funny thing with that is, in that decision, is I'm really glad that happened, and I'm glad that I decided to leave. I ended up sticking around for about 6 extra weeks just to wrap up everything and make sure everything was tied up, because I don't want to be that jerk who's like, good luck. You know, I feel like I owed them a lot. And so about a week before I was supposed to leave, that show that my wife was making all the money closed. So we were both basically
like
unemployed.
Unexpectedly?
Unexpectedly. I mean, that happens all the time.
Oh, okay.
Where a show will just, it's like, yeah, we can't do it.
If it wasn't doing well, though. Yeah,
I mean, wasn't doing
successful
well.
Show doesn't just close.
No, no, no.
Okay, okay.
But sometimes really successful, great shows close for whatever reason too early. They'll be around for 3 months, and then it's just a weird, weird world and a very small niche world.
Yeah. So you're on your own.
So we're all
both
on our
job. Yeah. Now it got real.
It got real. But then I remember I very distinctly remember the first day that I was on my own, and it was just me.
Yeah.
I got up in the morning, made some coffee, sat down, and I was like, I have all day to work on what I want to work on. This is awesome. I'd never had that before. And it was like, whoa. Like I hadn't even thought about it.
Yeah.
Like I can sit here all day and do what I was doing exhausted at night. And I just, man, I got a lot of work done. And then jobs started coming in.
But let's talk about that, the early days, right? So
yeah.
First off, that day one you just described, is that day one of your current venture or is that a different?
Yeah.
Okay. So let's unpack your company. What exactly is your brand known for?
Mm-hmm. The way that I would have described it is I opened the doors to my design studio, my one-man design studio, basically. But I was calling it a design studio where I was going to keep doing all the work that I was doing on the side, basically, which at that point was typographic illustration.
Okay.
And the types of clients that were calling me to do work were people like the New York Times did a few like the op-ed illustrations, publishers doing book covers, magazine, a lot of editorial illustration and magazine covers, and then advertising agencies. Things like, we're doing this Diet Coke campaign and we want you to do the artwork and we want to do these different phrases in this artful way.
Okay.
And so they'd hire me to create that art, and they'd do all the writing and everything. This agency called because they wanted to, McDonald's was their client, a big client, the DDB in Chicago. And they had an idea to have an artist paint a mural in a commercial for this new product. So I flew to LA and was in a McDonald's commercial at one point, which when they called me, and I was used to advertising agencies calling me to do stuff, they're like, oh, some lettering and typography for this new product. I'm like, great, great, great. And I think at that point I was doing a little bit of freelancing at Nickelodeon. Like I was in there doing key art for some of the broadcast. I was just kind of floating around doing a bunch of stuff. But that McDonald's thing, it wasn't until like the third meeting that I realized that they wanted me to be actually in the commercial, that was a wild experience. But
had you done murals up to that point?
I'd done a few big things for the Ace Hotel in New York.
Okay.
That was the first large scale thing that I'd done. And again, I was like, at that point, if somebody wanted me to do something, it seemed cool, but I didn't really know how to do it.
Yeah.
I would just be like, cool, let's do it. And just try to be confident and figure it out.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because figuring it out and like that was part of like the design process.
Yeah.
And like, where am I going to paint this giant 10 foot by 12 foot canvas? I don't have any room. So figuring that out, where am I going to go? Like,
that's awesome.
And I still was putting everything out there online and doing time-lapse videos and stuff of some of the bigger work. And I hadn't done that much, but there was a lot out there and I did a new website and everything. Mm-hmm. So people, I think, were finding me and my brand, if you were to call it, you know, it was just me. I always just used my name. I was hired for really typographic illustration.
Okay.
I mean, it's like, that's kind of what, that's the bread and butter.
So if I go to your clients and I say, well, what's Jeff known for? What would you say is unique about Jeff? What would that be?
I would hope that they would say great typography. I would hope that they would say that.
Yeah.
Which is funny because in Dallas, when I was walking around and talking to everybody, the one thing that everyone consistently said was, you got to work on your typography skills.
Mm.
So I did.
That's awesome.
That's like what I do now, which is funny.
Was that key to one of your learnings under Gail?
Yes. She was like the typography queen of the design industry. I mean, if I hadn't worked for her, I probably still would be struggling with it maybe.
Mm.
Or my work definitely wouldn't be what I am doing now. Working with her was absolutely essential. It was like finding a good mentor.
Yeah.
Which I think she was like the one and only real mentor that I ever had was key. Like if I didn't work with her, then I don't know what I'd be doing right now.
That's awesome. What has been some of the challenges in working for yourself? Because one of the things we haven't talked about is, you know, it seems as though customer acquisition just kind of happened for you, right? It's just, you know, you put work out online and clients are coming to you. Well, that, you know, that's kind of a dream scenario for a lot of people. Yeah, but what have been some of the challenges you've had as you've built your own brand?
Yeah, it's a kind of a unique situation where, like I mentioned, I really haven't ever done any specific marketing. All I've ever done is try to put work out there where people can find it, which is not as easy now as it was.
Yeah.
One challenge is always trying to be proactive about the projects that I'm doing. Now I have two kids. Things really changed when they came along. We were still in New York. And we moved back to Texas after our second was born, about a year after our second was born, just because it was too hard.
Yeah,
it's too hard. And everybody with kids had left and we didn't have any friends and nobody cared that I was even in New York anymore. Mm. I was still getting hired. And I would mention like, I'm down the street if you want to meet in person. They're like, oh, you're in New York? I'm like, why am I suffering here? You know? So one of the keys to my business is doing personal projects and doing, I think that a lot of people are using the word passion projects, which is what I had been doing at night. Just that those experimental projects that I would put out there and then get work from those.
Yeah.
Now I have so much out there that people just want me to keep doing what I've already put out there. And that's not sustainable. Mm-hmm. So I have to keep doing experimental personal projects and getting them out there in order to move forward because if not, things are just going to fizzle out and die, at least in my mind.
Yeah, okay.
But it's very, very hard to get the time to do it or the energy to do it now. Fortunately, I have a lot of work.
Yeah.
And it's great. Like, I love all the projects mostly that I get to do, but I'm not doing anything new. I'm just kind of doing the same types of things over and over. And I feel like I am almost stuck again now, and I need something. I've actually considered maybe going and working somewhere for a little bit. Mm. Just to, how do I switch this up again?
Yeah.
So I've been really trying to force myself to spend 20 minutes, 30 minutes in my workday thinking about something, an idea that I'm curious about. Right now, it's just, I need to paint. I need to paint more. I mean, that's very specific for me, what I'm doing right now.
Yeah.
But it's so hard. It's so hard for me to like justify the time, even though I know that if I don't do that, that I won't grow.
Yeah.
And I'm in control of the types of projects I'm getting. And I can keep recycling and keep doing the same projects over and over.
One of the things that you stated a few times, and I'm seeing this theme in your life and your journey, is just that continual growth. Pushing yourself, you always frame it in the realm of creativity. But do you think that truth should apply to all entrepreneurs, to constantly be pushing yourself to grow in that, in whatever area you are in?
Yeah, I don't see how someone could want to be an entrepreneur if they're not just psyched about what they're doing. And why wouldn't you want to be the best at that thing? I know that the more I learn, the farther I can see. You know, like I know that I can keep getting better until I die.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I want to keep making work, and I want to keep growing and doing new things and interacting with people and trying to make an impact in a lot of different ways. If you're not going to try to be the best like version of whatever your business, why would you even want to do it? Go work for somebody.
you're preaching to the choir. I love that. I absolutely love it. I'm glad that those are the words out of your mouth. And I hope our followers listening, you caught that. But I want to ask this question because for veterans in any industry, there's always kind of a time and place question to be answered or spoken about. And it would be crazy to not ask it. And for those that are also in the creative space, you came on the scene digitally, online, if you will, in a time when all the creative sources were new. And being the first on any platform is always going to help with being discovered, right? If you're the first on TikTok, you're making a mint right now,
right?
Because of your fan base. you talked about Flickr. And
yeah,
I assume when Instagram came online, you were probably one of the earlier Instagram users. And so if you were to start your brand today, how would you do it? And this is really a question for those in my audience who are in the creative space trying to figure things out. But at the same time, if you are listening and you're not in the creative space, the same stretching thought process can be applied to anything, because time continues on, technology continues on, but there are principles that still ring true. And if you don't believe me, go back and listen to my episode with Ben Chestnut, founder of MailChimp, when he spoke to some of the link efforts he used for SEO, because they still apply. I mean, it's crazy. So I want to ask that specific question for you. If you were to start today, how would you do it?
I think I would kind of start the way that I started before, with a desire to make great work. That's what I love to do.
But how did you like, discover it?
Yeah, I know. So I don't know. I didn't know what I was doing back then. All I cared about was just pumping out the work. And I wanted to share it because I had gotten into a habit of talking to those people and sharing my work. And I knew there was a value of getting work out in front of people and getting some feedback on it. And so Flickr was a place where people could comment and you could kind of gauge if a lot of people liked it or if they didn't. And that was kind of a good way for me to bounce ideas around off of people. And that was the motivation for me, was, are people engaging with this? Are they not? It wasn't about followers or likes or anything at that point, which is why now is a common probably frustration with a lot of people in my position. It was like, dang it, I should have done more back then, because I don't have the giant social media following that a lot of my friends do, who when all that was happening, they were like, oh, here's an opportunity. Where I was more focused on, I would not consider myself like a good business person. So like, if I was to start right now, I would just want to make great work first, because that's my job, and just try to keep connected with people. I think connection and community is super key, especially coming from New York. That's been a very important, like, scaling back. Like, in New York, everybody wants to take over the world, and I certainly did, but it's tiring. And so coming back to Texas, I was like, I just want to be a Dallas guy. I want to have a community of people and clients who I know, and we are friends.
Yeah.
And my income is coming from a community and a close-knit. Like, that's what I want. I'm not really overly concerned about being rich. I'm not going to ever be rich, you know? I just want to keep making the best work I can and, like, have, like, a really solid community of people who trust me to do the work that I want to do, and so that I can, like, really push the limits of what my capabilities are. That's kind of where I'm at right now, is, like, that scaling back of, like, I don't care about... It's nice to get those giant advertising projects, and... We're doing this great project right now for Patagonia that is super duper fun. I'm getting to collaborate with a really good friend and amazing illustrator on it, and we're getting paid really well.
That's awesome.
So it's like, when all those things can happen, it's great. But I'd rather work on a great, fun project than a boring project and make a lot of money. I'm going to have to do that a lot, and I'm glad when I get to make money, but it's... a bummer when the work sucks.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And when it's just like, I'm trudging through it just for the paycheck.
Yeah. No, I get it. You know, I want to ask this question, and it's really kind of an identity question, but I've had numerous conversations with creatives. I've had numerous conversations with creators that create apparel for, let's say, and they just sell on Etsy. I mean, they're really designers, but they don't call themselves fashion designers because there's a persona they think that comes with that title.
Yeah, I get that.
Do you wrestle with any notion that you're an entrepreneur or a creative, or do you separate the two? Because a lot of people do. I mean, do you wrestle with that at all?
It can be confusing to me what I am, because it's actually kind of hard for me to call myself an entrepreneur, even though I am. I don't know why. I think I'm really hard on myself. Like I just said, I was like, I'm not a good business person. I was like, however, I've run a successful business since 2011, which I have to like have those two of the little voices, you know?
I think a lot of, when it comes, especially on the creative side.
Right.
When you're creative,
grappling with you.
I've met numerous creatives that, you know, I'm using air quotes, you know, freelancers.
Right.
But they've been doing it for 15 years.
Yeah.
And it's like, you're an entrepreneur. Like you've built a business and a brand.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a retail store? No. Is there an e-commerce store? No.
Right.
But you're an entrepreneur.
Mm-hmm.
And I find the challenge to really be concentrated in the creative space.
Yeah.
To identify as an entrepreneur. And, that's what I was trying to figure out. Being that you were raised by an entrepreneur who had a brick and mortar bakery.
Right.
Do you have a persona of what an entrepreneur is? And do you wrestle with whether or not you consider yourself one?
Right. Yeah. Because I don't have like a product. I guess I kind of do, but my clients are other creatives usually. But that's shifting a little bit, where I'm trying to get more work where I'm working with businesses and business owners.
Yeah.
And that is a step in a good direction for me right now in my career, because that means that I can help a business grow and improve with design. And I've gotten better at being able to walk people who don't know about the creative process or whatever, walk them through a process of doing that, where working with an agency or art director, they know, we all know what we're doing. You know, we don't have to explain, like, I can send these rough sketches over and they're like, how about this one? And I'll be like, why does it look so like such like a cartoon? It's like, it's a sketch. Where you can't just send a business owner a sketch of an idea, because they're going to think that's what you want to do.
Yeah.
So things like that.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's a weird question. I've never really thought about it, because I know what I do is really specific, and I'm not like, my clients aren't like the masses of people wanting to buy a product or something.
Yeah.
I have a very specific client base that I want to work with.
I think part of why it's probably challenging to answer
is because there's this narrative of what entrepreneurship is.
Right. Yeah.
And the reality is that if you're taking risk to build something with the chance of failure and there's a transaction taking place, you're an entrepreneur.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I mean, again, that's a really rough definition, but the truth remains the same. I believe someone can have a side gig and be an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I just think that, I think the narrative that's out there of what entrepreneurship is has done more damage than good. It has, I don't think it has not created these aspirational goals for people, because there are people, I, you know, I call them the wantrepreneurs, the ones who have a 9-to-5 and a book full of dreams and ideas, but some level of fear and reluctance to move forward on it, because there's something out there that says, if you're not all in on it, you're not an entrepreneur.
Right.
It's
right.
Like, that's not true at all. That person could very much be an entrepreneur for certain pockets of the day, because that's what their lifestyle affords and they're trying to do it incrementally.
That's true. Like, when you put it like that, that's more helpful. I have these expectations, even in my own field, where, oh, I should be like hiring designers and I should be growing this business and I should be like making tons of money. And if I'm an entrepreneur, I should be like a gazillionaire. And if I was really successful or something.
Yeah.
I don't want to run a big or manage a bunch of people. It's not what I want to do.
Exactly.
I want to make stuff.
Yep.
And I'm good at it.
And you've been doing it.
Right.
And that's the thing, is I think, again, there's this false persona of what an entrepreneur is. And there's so much diversity in entrepreneurship, which is why I love the Startup Story.
It's awesome.
Yeah. You know, it's, you know, we get to explore that. And unfortunately, our time is coming to an end. So I want to make sure I honor my audience's time with this, with the asking the same questions that I ask every founder. And, and that one being about gratitude, you know, and we've talked a little bit about the people I suspect you're grateful for. But when you look back across your entire life journey, who are the people you look to with such immense gratitude for their contribution to where you are today? And the reason I ask that question is that I believe if we forget those people, if we forget their contribution, we think we did this on our own. And ultimately, that isolates us and that will always lead to failure. So who do you look back to with such immense gratitude for their contribution to where you're at?
Oh, man, that's a good question. I actually think about these people a lot, because it's like that pay it forward thing. It's like I can be more generous when I think about my gratitude. Definitely my parents.
Yeah,
my wife, but my career, like, so grateful that I got an opportunity to work with Gail Anderson and those people in Dallas that took the time to talk to me. People like Paul Jurdy and Todd Hart and Rob Wilson are people who spent some time talking to me. And I know now from that is like, if I spend 5 minutes saying something to somebody, it could mean nothing, but they might remember it for their whole life, and it could really help them. Even just that little word or something. Yeah. And that's definitely, I remember little sound bites from people that helped me almost every day. All those people that took 5 minutes to help me.
I love it.
Yeah.
You know, and for our final question, you know, we've been talking at a very high level about your personal journey to Howdy Jeff, where we are today. And, and people have had a chance to kind of listen in at a 30,000 foot view of what that story looks like. But I want to bring it down to the one. I want to bring, you know, I call it a mentor minute, where this is you sitting with one of my listeners, whether it be the frustrated entrepreneur who's been doing this for 10 years, lack of traction, constantly having cash flow issues, maybe COVID completely jacked their business up and they don't know if they can make it out of 2020. But either way, they're frustrated, they're discouraged. They might just want to call it quits. Or maybe it is that entrepreneur that we talked about, who's got some narrative as to why they can't just go all in on something and move forward on it, because they have an idea, a false idea of what entrepreneurship is. Whoever it is, whatever person you want to speak to, if you were having coffee with them right now, what would you say to that one person?
I think if you're in the creative field, specifically a designer, creative, photographer, something like that, I hate the idea, this phrase that's floating around everywhere that's like, live your dream. Yay. Because I see that. I know you see that all over the place and think, I can't live my dream. I got kids. I got this. I got to work. I got to live my life. It's not that easy. Apparently, it's easy for everyone else, because that's what I'm seeing. And I see that all the time. And it frustrates me, because it's not easy. It's actually extremely difficult. And I wish people would stop posting that stuff, because it gives me, and I'm sure it gives you, a false sense of like expectation that you have to be successful and like taking a picture of yourself in like a flowery meadow and like life is hunky-dory and awesome, but it's not going to be. I've had a lot of struggles and hard times, but getting to work on things that I want to work on, getting to run a business the way that I want to, even when it's hard and doesn't maybe work all the time, just getting that opportunity is worth it, at least for me, because I own it. And if I can take ownership of my life and my work, it's worth the struggle.
Once you've had a few moments to process all the value that Jeff Rogers brought us in this week's episode, please hit me up on LinkedIn, Facebook, or Instagram and share with me your thoughts on this episode. And lastly, if you've been around the Startup Story for any length of time, then you know how much emphasis I put on the idea that entrepreneurs support other entrepreneurs. One of the most common challenges for all small businesses is gaining awareness. And with that in mind, there are two key ways you can show up to support Jeff Rogers. First, connect with him on LinkedIn, and we'll have a link in our show notes for easy access. But the other way is to connect with him on all the social channels by following Frogers. It's actually, I know it sounds weird and unique, but it's actually the last letter of his first name, F, Jeff, and then his last name, Rogers, R-O-G-E-R-S. So Frogers, you gotta love creatives. Remember, entrepreneurs support other entrepreneurs. So let's show up for Jeff Rogers in a very big way. And as a thank you for all the value he delivered today. And now for my personal ask. The Startup Story community has been so incredible about sharing our podcast with others, but we have more stories to tell and more people to reach. We too are a startup, and word of mouth is everything. So please follow us on Facebook and Instagram at The Startup Story, or on Twitter at Startup Story _. If you're on LinkedIn, please search for The Startup Story and follow our company page. LinkedIn is a really powerful way to raise awareness of the show. But the most impactful way you can help us grow our audience is to leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Or if you listen to the show via Spotify, then please simply share the podcast directly from your Spotify app or wherever you listen to the show. These simple actions can make a huge impact in getting these amazing founder stories out to the masses. And please make sure to tag or mention The Startup Story when you do share so that we can connect with you and say thank you directly. I'm so incredibly appreciative of the fact that you listen to the show each and every week. And I look forward to sharing these amazing stories with you every Tuesday with hopes of encouraging and inspiring you to start your story. If you like this podcast and are thinking of creating your own, consider talking to my producer, Danny Osment. He helps thought leaders, influencers, executives, and authors create, launch, and produce podcasts that grow their business and make a real impact in this world. You can contact him today at emeraldcitypro.com/startupstory.